It occurred to I've read most of an interesting book about Coulomb, and while reading it, it occurred to me there was something else I should have said while we were talking about him. So just a little glance back here. What the motivation was for his developing the torsion balance and how he came to measure Coulomb's law. In 1777, there was a prize to improve compasses. And he devised an improved suspension for a compass needle held by a long thread that has less friction and so on, so that the compass works better. And he could measure very small changes in the Earth's magnetic field as the day progressed. Every day it changes a little bit. Then in 1784, he studied the torsion of the wire itself, or of a thread that was being used, quote, in order to determine the laws of cohesion and elasticity in metals and in all solid bodies. Remember, he was an engineer. He had built this fort and so on. So he was very interested in materials properties, and he thought materials were little solid things that had elasticity, and then between them there was coherence. So that he thought by studying the force law of torsion and also of stretching, he could get information about these force laws within the molecules. So remember, this is exactly what Newton said that scientists, that is experimental philosophers, should be doing, is to determine the force laws between these tiny particles. And that's what Coulomb was doing. And then in 1785-9, he determined the 1 over r squared laws for electrical charges and for magnets interacting. Incidentally, the way he confirmed Hooke's law for torsion is using mathematics, that the period for oscillation of the compass needle or of a metal cylinder that would rotate back and forth suspended by a wire, the period was independent of the amplitude. Right? Small, large, it always had the same time. Right, and this was this turns out to happen only if you have 1 over r squared, only if you have Hooke's law. So that's how he did it. Anyhow, I thought that was interesting that his actual, we're using the electrostatic Coulomb's law to talk about what holds molecules together. But the reason that he got into that whole area of study was he was interested in what holds molecules together. I just think that's sort of neat. Okay, so anyhow, as we were saying last time, despite Earnshaw saying that Coulomb's law alone won't do it, might there still be shared pair bonds, as Lewis thought, in lone pairs of electrons? How do you know? You have to see or feel. And last time we talked about feeling. And I wanted to mention an article that was in Science just 2 weeks ago about an improvement in scanning probe microscopy, studying a single molecule of pentosine. That's what pentosine is, 5 benzene rings fused together, on a surface of copper, scanned with a single atom tip at very low temperature, 5 Kelvin. So here's a layer, looked at the side, a layer of copper and a pentosine molecule lying down on it. So you bring a tip made out of gold that comes down maybe to one atom, maybe it doesn't look that ideal. And you scan back and forth, but you don't get very good resolution. You see that there's a molecule there, but it's very difficult to see that there are atoms in the molecule. You scan back and forth over it and the bip, 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 bip. But it's not that good because the gold atoms are big. Okay, so what you do is you let a little bit of carbon monoxide into the vacuum chamber and it adsorbs on the copper. The carbon sticks to the copper and they stand up like that. Then you move this needle that you're scanning with over above one of the above the COs. And as you scan back and forth, you can see the two COs. This is an image they took of two CO molecules being scanned with the gold. But then you go to on top of one of them, that's there, and just barely touch it, and then you put 2.5 volts relative to the copper onto that tip. Now, 2.5 volts doesn't sound like very much. That's less than 2 little batteries, right? However, the distance is very small, right? So that turns out to be 10 to the 10th volts per meter. So you get a zap. And what happens on the zap is that the CO turns over and sticks to the gold instead of the copper. So now you have a tip which is a single oxygen atom, right? So you can then they started scanning with a tip, and now you see that CO is gone, and the other CO2, the other CO molecule is being scanned with that new tip touching it. So it's oxygen to oxygen that you see that other one still there. But now, of course, what you want to do is see the pentacene. So you take your tip back there and scan back and forth, now touching only with a small oxygen atom. And this is 6 pentacene molecules that you can see on the surface of copper with that thing. And if you look at a single pentacene molecule, it can look like that. And you're getting to where you almost believe in bonds, right? Certainly in atoms. Certainly you believe in molecules, having seen a picture, having felt a picture like this. Right, Brian?
Why are they glowing?
Why are they what?
Why are they glowing?
It's not glowing. This scale on the right is a measure of hertz. That's frequency. Now, the way this is actually done, if you touch too hard, you'll just move the molecule. Right? So what they do is they vibrate it really fast, like 10,000 hertz or something like that. But and over, they just vibrate about a tenth or 2/10 the size of a bond. So just like this, right? And now if it's close to an atom, it changes the frequency. They just move it across, going like this, and see what the frequency of vibration is. Okay, and that's how much the frequency changes. So minus 2 hertz here is when something is high beneath you, and minus 7 hertz is when something is low. So this shows high and lowness. It's a topograph of the thing. Hi. Okay, so scanning probe microscopies, AFM, STM, SNOM, and this new single atom thing are really powerful. So sharp probes like this one can resolve individual molecules and individual atoms, as we've seen, and even bonds, at least almost. But we didn't quite have the resolution there to see whether they're really pairs of electrons between. Okay, not quite fine enough. Okay, so where do you get it fine enough? You get it by looking instead of feeling. You remember the motto of Yale is lux, light and truth. So maybe we'll get the truth about it from light. Now there's a problem with using light. Although in this application in chemistry, there's a lonely architectural curiosity down in this part of the building out toward Prospect Street. That's the supply entrance, or as used to be. It's now moved to the other building. But anyhow, if you go in there, back in the shades, you see this, which is a microscope. What building would you expect to see that on? The chemistry building? Biology, right? Because biological things that you look at are much bigger than molecules. Right, but maybe your eyeball, shown there, can actually do something here. Maybe you actually can see. Have you ever seen this picture before? This is the famous flea that was published in 1665 by Robert Hooke in his classic Micrographia. And he said in that book, "But nature is not limited by our narrow comprehension. Future improvements of glasses, lenses that is, may yet further enlighten our understanding, and ocular inspection may demonstrate that which as yet we may think too extravagant either to feign or to suppose." So maybe if you make a really super lens, you'll be able to see bonds, right? Sound good? Can we build a big enough microscope? Put our eye there and see it? Any problems? Yeah. The light is too big. It's like using that gold atom. It's too big for what you're trying to see. Okay, now, you know that the light's interaction this kind of way has the way you see is through interference. Like you've seen a slick of oil on water. So suppose you have an oil slick that's about 200 nanometers thick. Now, if you take light that's about 400 nanometers long, and the path difference for the one that reflects from the second layer as opposed to the first layer, if it goes twice through 200 nanometers, is something like 400. So if you have light that comes in, if that difference, 400 nanometers, is one wavelength, as it is for this purple light, then the wave of the second one will be just one wave behind the first one, and they'll come out in phase with one another and strong. Okay. On the other hand, if the light was red and that 400 nanometers was only half a wavelength, then they would interfere and destroy one another. One would be a maximum when the other was a minimum. if there's half a wavelength difference between the two. Okay, so you don't get any scattering. So you see these rainbows, you know, when you see oil on water that comes from that. And in fact, Hooke in 1665 knew this. He said, on the colors observable in mica and other thin bodies. And this is a picture he drew, which looks very much like that picture I just showed you. And the idea is that here's mica, several molecular layers of mica, or thin layers of mica, and light's coming in and bounces from the top, but also and keeps going on out, a train of pulses. Remember, he thought it was a train of pulses. And it also can go a little bit through and reflect and be a little bit behind the first one. And his idea was that when you have a strong pulse followed by a weak pulse at a certain time interval, that's yellow. But if you have a thicker layer, then you do this trick, and as it comes out, the small pulse is further behind the big pulse, and now that's red, right? Or if it gets even further behind, it looks like the little one is ahead of the big one. Got the idea? And that turned out to be blue. So that's his idea, and this is what he and Newton were fighting over, Newton's experimentum crucis, and this kind of thing that had to do with pulses. So Hooke really was on the track of the right idea. Okay, so that was blue. Okay, now, you need for this purpose short wavelengths of light, and we're going to talk about that, and you get that from X-rays. And over here, just catty-cornered from your lab, is Chris Incarvito, who runs the Chemical Instrumentation Center, and last year, this time, he got two new instruments, two new X-ray diffractometers. Here's the one he's showing us. It costs about $200,000, and if you look with a magnifying glass, you can see that there's a crystal right there where those things all point toward one another. So you have an X-ray tube, a thin beam of X-rays comes, hits the crystal. When it hits the crystal, it gets scattered into a number of little beams. And then that CCD detector sees where those beams hit and how intense they are. And that's the information, as you'll soon see, that allows you to figure out where the atoms are and even what bonds are in a crystal. Okay. Now, there's another one that he got at the same time. It was a two-for-one deal where he got, this one cost about $350,000. And it's the same basic idea, except the detector is curved so that when the X-rays come in and hit the crystal and get scattered, you can collect many more of them at much higher angles than with a flat plate. Okay. Now, so this is a way of seeing, using light to study individual molecules, atoms, and bonds. Can you do that? Can you see individual molecules, atoms, and bonds with light? There's a problem, and the problem was stated by Matthew back there, which is the wavelength of light. It's too big to do this. So let's think about how we get around this. What is light? You've taken physics, a lot of you. Yeah, Evan? Now, waves. Okay, so that's good. So it's electromagnetic waves. Good start. Okay, now, you say it's a wave. In what way is light a wave? I've seen waves on water. Is it like that? Why do you say it's a wave? Light. What's wavy about it? Yeah, Mike?
Well, it's a wave and a particle. So.
But let's not talk about the particle. Let's just talk about how it's like a wave. In what way is it a wave?
It displays interference.
Pardon me?
It displays interference.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good answer. Well, I've got another. It diffracts. That's the same deal. Could we do this later? Maybe I'm giving a lecture now.
You may want to bring that microphone up.
I know. It works fine. Thanks. Okay. Yeah? Sorry, I was distracted. Yeah.
If you grab the electromagnetic force at any position, it becomes a sine wave.
Aha, it's a plot, a graph of it looks like a wave, right? A graph looks like a wave. So you have a charged particle, and as you said, it oscillates. The charged particle moves up and down, which creates an oscillate, so that it will, if there's light there, it will be pushed up and down by the light going past. Light is an oscillating electric field. How do you know it's an electric field? You put a charge there and see if it gets pushed. Okay, so it gets pushed up and down, it's oscillating. So if we made a graph of the force on a charge at one position, at that position, say, as a function of time, it would look like a wave. So the graph looks like a wave, right? Or you could plot it a different way. You could, that's the force on a charge at one position. You could look at the force at an instant on charges at different positions. So if the charge was there, it would be up, down. If it's there, up, down, depending on where the charge is. And that's a wave also, right? The electric field, the direction the charge gets pushed, as a function of position. So that's how light is a wave. Okay, now, if you have an electron that's getting pushed by this electric field, it will oscillate. What is it that creates light? How does a radio transmitter work? What makes light waves? Yeah. Tony? Well, but what's the purpose? Why, it's not the LC circuit. That's physically what does it, but what is the actual phenomenon that causes there to be light? Yeah. It's the acceleration of electrons up and down. Okay? So if you have an electron and it's hit by a light wave, that'll make it accelerate up and down. The force, oscillating force, will do that. But that very thing, the accelerating up and down, creates light. So now light, even though it came in as a beam in just one direction, hits this thing and makes the electron oscillate up and down, and that causes new light to come out in almost all directions. Any direction in which you can see that the electron is moving, light will come out. If you're looking right along the direction that it's moving, you can't see that it's moving. Right, and then there will be no light. So right up and down, there's no light coming out. But every other direction, there's light coming out. Okay, so that's called scattering. Okay, now why don't protons, that is the hydrogen nucleus, or the nucleus of uranium or anything else, why don't they scatter light the way electrons do? It's electrons that work. Yeah. They're too heavy. They don't accelerate when the field, at least they don't accelerate very much, so they scatter very little. It's the light electrons that you're going to be able to see, not the nuclei, using light. Okay, they're too heavy. Okay, so you've seen interference. Suppose you have several electrons there. So you've seen interference patterns like this on water. And you know that if you have two things that are generating waves, that they interfere. Now look at the pattern you get with interference. You see that here stuff is say way down. Here it's way up. Here way down, way up. So if you can see that there, that if you're a long distance away, what are you going to see from this? Well, those lines trace where things are really active, where there's a big mountain and big valley. In halfway in between those, there's not any motion at all during the interference of these two things. So that if you're very far away from these two things, and of course the electrons we're looking at are going to be very, very close together, so any sensible distance we're going to be really far away, they're going to converge on those lines. So they're going to be rays that come out. Okay, so from far away, what you'll see when there are two spots there, you're going to see rays come out at certain points. Okay, and the angles between those rays tell you something about how far apart those electrons are. Okay? So the angular intensity distribution of the line that gets scattered at great distance depends on the distribution of the scatterers at the origin, where the crystal is. Okay, so this is not just crystal. This is how I see you, or you see me, or you see the screen, or anything. All this is scattering. It's electrons that are doing this trick and sending the light back out to you. Okay, now, if you use a lens, you can take this information that's coming out at all different distances, capture it by the lens, and the lens refocuses it to make an image of what did the scattering. Okay, that's fancy, and if you study optics, you'll figure out how that works. But it reassembles the information of the scattered waves into an image, and it can be an enlarged image. So that's how a microscope works. Okay, or it's how your eye works. Right, but a lens for X-rays is hard to come by. It used to be impossible to have a lens that would do X-rays. Now, with microfabrication of things, it's getting possible to do it, but not good enough to make a lens that you can make a microscope to look at electrons. And be sure to read this webpage on X-ray diffraction, which will supplement what I say here a good deal. Okay. So the process of X-ray diffraction sees molecules and atoms, and as we'll see, even bonds. But it doesn't see individuals. It sees them collectively. It's the interference among a bunch of these things that gives rise to the information that comes to your eye ultimately, or to a recorder, right? Remember, scanning probe microscopy was different because it felt them, and it felt individual molecules or individual atoms. And if one atom was displaced a little bit, you'd see that's where it is, right? But the X-ray is going to be different because we're going to take the light that's coming from everything and try to unscramble it to get an image of what the average thing looks like, way blown up. Okay, so suppose you had a crystal of, say, sort of like benzene molecules assembled like this. So most of it is very regular, but at any given instant, a few of them are displaced a little one way or the other, or one might be missing, or there might be an extra one in between, or there might be some atoms missing or something. But what you'll see is not that. That's what you'd see with scanning probe microscopy, feeling every individual thing. What you'll see with X-ray is the average of all of these, so it'll sort of blur it out a little bit. So if you want to see real high detail in X-ray, you have to operate at really low temperature, like liquid nitrogen temperature or even colder, so that things don't vibrate very much, so the picture doesn't get blurred. Okay, so there's a blurring problem both from motion and from defects in the crystal. Time. So the image you get from X-ray is time averaged, right? So as a molecule vibrates, you see its average position of atoms. And it's also space averaged because the scattering is cooperative. It's coming from all the molecules, not just one at a time. Okay, and there are therefore advantages for probe microscopy, which operates in real space. Now, X-rays were discovered in 1895 by Röntgen, and you've seen pictures of Frau Röntgen's hand here from 1896. But in 1912, so what is that, 17 years later, Max von Laue invented this technique called X-ray diffraction. And he took a picture like that of these beams that are coming out when the X-rays hit a crystal of copper sulfate. Okay? And then he was able to unscramble that information and get back to what the structure of the molecule was. In fact, the people who figured out how to go backwards and take the lines and figure out what must have been the pattern that caused the lines to be like that was William Lawrence Bragg, who, you see, was born in 1890, and he did this in 1912, so he was only 22 years old. You only have a few years to go to catch up with him, right? And in fact, he got the Nobel Prize in 1915, and still he's the youngest person to get the Nobel Prize, which he shared with his father, who sort of went on his back. The young Bragg was the one who really did the trick. Sir William Bragg just came along to pick up the prize. And you probably have seen this picture. Do you know what it is? That's X-ray scattering, the beams coming out from what, Christine? From what? DNA. This is the picture that Rosalind Franklin took of DNA in 1952, which showed that it was a double helix and so on. And we're going to talk about how that shows it's a double helix. But we've gone a long way from that to when, 9 years ago already, people in this department and MB&B next door did the complete atomic structure of the large ribosomal subunit at 2.4 angstrom resolution, and that's what it looked like. And it had it's 25 nanometers, 250 atomic sizes in diameter. It has more than 100,000 atoms, not counting hydrogen. Why wouldn't we count hydrogen? Why doesn't hydrogen show up very well in X-ray? Yeah, Satran? What?
Satran is very small.
So what does small have to do? What is it that does the scattering? It's not the diameter. Yeah? The nucleus has nothing to do with it. Sonny? Pardon me? There's only one electron there. Other atoms have a lot more electrons, so they do a lot more scattering, because electrons are what do the scattering. Okay. So now, what can X-ray diffraction show? Can it show molecules? Can it show atoms? And the real payoff is, can it show bonds to show us what these things are that make chemistry? Okay, and how does diffraction work? That's what I want you to understand, not just have a black box that gives you a picture like these things in the instrument center do, where essentially you just have to push a button nowadays. So like all light, x-rays are waves. They just have very short wavelengths. Now, I want to show you what I call a wave machine here. And you can see something rather like it on the web at that website. I actually haven't checked in the last couple months, but I think that it's still there. But let's hope this works. There we go. So here's my wave machine. Oops. Here we are. There we go. So here's a wave machine. So here's a wave that's coming in from the left, and these dark dots here are electrons, but let's forget this electron at first. We'll put that in later. Okay, so this wave comes in and hits these two electrons, makes them bounce up and down, and they give off light in all directions. Okay? But now we're going to stand far out there, you know, down someplace in Cincinnati or something like this, and look at these two waves coming out and see whether they're in phase with one another, so they reinforce one another, or whether they cancel each other. So for that purpose, I've drawn this vertical line here that comes straight, that's perpendicular to both lines, and you can see that if the scattering is in the same direction that the light came in, right, they're bound to be in phase. Everybody see that? Okay. But now suppose you look at a different angle, like that angle there. What would you expect? Sinead? Can't hear. They exactly cancel, because one's pushing one way when the other's pushing the other way. So they cancel. But if we go to there, then we've got juice again, right? So it's going to be, there's going to be a light there at that angle, at that angle, at that angle, at that angle. How about if we were between it? How about if we were about there? Now they're a little bit out of phase, but still they'll be pushing more or less at the same time, so you'll see a weak light. So it'll be strong at exactly the right angle, then it'll get a little weaker, nothing, then stronger, 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 weaker, weaker, weaker. So if you stand off in Cincinnati, you'll see light coming out at different angles. Right? And it'll be strong, weak, strong, weak. Okay, that's easy enough. Now, what if we had the two electrons closer together? So forget the bottom one now, and let's put this one in here that's twice as close together. Can you see how things are going to change with respect to our angles? Okay, so for example, neglect the middle one, think about the bottom one. We saw that there was light, still there'll be light straight ahead. Okay, that's fine. But how about if we go to this angle, where the top and the bottom one gave the first spot, the first strong reflection, not straight ahead. Everybody see what I'm talking about? How about that if we had the first and the second, rather than the first and the third? Kevin, what do you say? Nothing. They cancel, right? Because they're closer together, so you don't get out of phase as quickly and back into phase. So you have to go to a higher angle. You have to go to that angle, which would have been the second reflection from the top to the bottom, right? But it's the first reflection that you'll be able to see for the first and the second. So there's an interesting relationship here between distance between the electrons and angle. Can you see what that relationship is? Not precisely, but exactly. It's reciprocal, right? The closer together the electrons are, the higher the angle will be for the first or the second or the third reflection. Does everybody see that idea? So the closer together in real space, the further apart the angles will be. So that's sort of neat. Now, suppose we had a very long row of these electrons, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 382 of them, okay? Okay, and suppose we're just a little bit off the correct angle. Suppose we're there, Okay? So the first one and the second one are almost in phase. And the third one, again, is almost in phase with those. But what, so that it won't be quite as sharp, quite as diffuse as it was before. The reflection won't be quite as strong as it was before because they're not exactly in phase. Right? But what will happen if there are 300 of them? Right? Suppose they were off by just they were off by just 2 degrees of phase, right? What happens when you get to the 90th one compared to the first? Each one is 2 degrees off in phase from the previous one, okay? What happens when you get to the 90th one? It's 180 degrees off and it cancels the first one. And the 91st cancels the second, and the 93rd cancels the third, and whatever, and so on. So you get nothing. So if you have a really, really long regular array of these things, they have to be precisely the right angle in order to see anything. If it's a little bit off, there'll be one that cancels the first, another one that cancels the second, and so on. So if you have a long row, instead of getting something that looks like this, you'll get something that looks like this. In angle, right? There'll be real sharp little beams coming out. Everybody got that? Okay. So let's that, and you can see the same thing in this animation on the web, but I like the real thing there where you can move it in real time. So that's the same idea here. We'll just click through this rapidly. So you have this in and out of phaseness and so on. Now, as we said, there are two scattering directions that will always be in phase, or we said one of them. You know, what's one direction? Even if they're not right above one another, that line that's straight ahead, the what comes out will be in phase because the one got excited earlier, but it had longer time to catch up. Right, so the overall path is the same in both cases. So straight ahead will always scatter in phase, no matter what pattern you have. But there's another angle where they'll be in phase, which is this one, which is that you define a thing called the scattering vector. Let's not worry about that. It's how you go from where it would have gone here to where it actually goes. The vector that connects those is called the scattering vector, and is perpendicular to this line here. Right? Now you'll notice that if the angle coming in and the angle going out are the same, then this one gets excited later by that much. But this one got excited earlier and catches up, right? So the overall path here is the same as the overall path here, and the overall path for anything that's along this line will be in phase. Did you ever see that principle? That if the line comes in and out at the same angle, everything in a plane will scatter in phase. You saw it this morning if you combed your hair, right? Because that's how a mirror works. Right, the light comes in and out, and the light reinforces. But at any other angle, it doesn't. Okay, so that's called specular reflection. A speculum is a mirror. Okay, no matter where you are, where the electron is on that line. So all the electrons on a line in two dimensions or on a plane perpendicular to the scattering vector scatter in phase at the specular angle, in and out. Same reflection. That's why these spots that come out in X-ray are called reflections, because of the analogy. Okay, now suppose you have a complicated pattern of these things. Obviously, for any direction in and out, there'll be a certain phase relationship for all these different little waves that are coming. But how can you sort of get your head around it and see what directions will be good and what directions will be bad? Well, there's one neat way of doing it, which is to look for a set of evenly spaced lines that contain all the stuff that's doing the scattering. You see, although that pattern looks sort of random, that they all fall on evenly spaced lines. Now, that means that if you have specular reflection in and out the same angle with respect to these planes, right? Anything on a given line will be in phase with anything else on that same line. Not necessarily with the other lines, but at least on that line. So if we're going to talk specular reflection in and out at the same angle, then these three will all scatter as one. And these four will all scatter as one, and these two and that one, okay? So we can sort of, if that's the scattering vector, if that's the direction we're talking about that is in and out at the same angle, then we can condense them like that. So we only have four spots to talk about if we can do this trick. And now, what's the advantage of having those planes be evenly spaced? Right? Because notice that if light comes in and out, specular, in and out the same angle there, and just suppose that's three electrons doing that scattering, all in phase with one another, reinforcing. But that next one will have a different path length. It'll differ by that much, the red amount. But suppose that distance is one wave, right? Then they'll be in phase coming out. They'll reinforce, the four will reinforce the three, if the wavelength and the angle is such that that is, that the red is one path length difference, one wave difference in path length. Okay, so that would add another four to the original three. And if the next one is the same, it'll be two waves ahead of the behind the first one, one behind the second. So again, it'll be in phase. And we'll add another two and another one. And we get that all 10 electrons are scattering in phase. So it'll be very strong at that angle. If we're able to find a set of evenly spaced lines that contain all those electrons, right, evenly spaced, that'll determine what the spacing is, determines what the angle is. That's what we talked about before, the reciprocal, the closer together, the bigger the angle. Okay? Now, suppose the first path difference is only half a wavelength instead of a whole wavelength. How will that change the picture? Well, so it'll be a half a wave there. That'll be destructive interference. But the next one will be constructive with the first. And the last one will be constructive with the second, but destructive with the first and third. Everybody with me what I'm saying here? Okay, so instead of that, we're going to have plus 3, minus 4, plus 2, minus 1. And you sum them up, and there's 0. Nothing comes out. They cancel there. Happened to. But at any rate, you can see that there's going to be a pattern of intensities. That the intensities are going to tell you how many electrons there are on alternate things. How much they... I chose it so that they would exactly cancel, but it could have come out to be two or something. So you get a pattern of intensities that tell you what this pattern of electrons in real space was. Right? So this regular spacing from one set to the next, to the next, to the next, determines what angles the light comes out at, what angle the rays. But the pattern of stuff that's at each of these positions here, repeat here, repeat here, repeat here, determines how intense they'll be. So the X-ray pattern is angles, positions of the spots on the detector, and intensities. And the pattern, the angles, tell you what the spacing is. And the intensities tell you what the pattern is that's being repeated in a crystal. Okay. Now we're going to do an experiment here. And this is going to take some work and collaboration, and we need it to be very dark, so you'll have to close your laptop when we get to this, and I'll have to get out my thing here to darken this screen. I see, and I need to get those projectors off and turn, but I don't want to turn the sound one off until I show you what we're going to do. Okay, so back at the, so if my lovely assistant here, Andrew, can get back to the, what we have is a laser back in the projection booth here, and if he takes out that card that's blocking it, you'll see that this is the laser dot. And what I need to do, that's very bright, and I need to block most of it. So I have a little beam catcher here that I'm going to put on the screen. And this is a moving target because the screen moves. So I don't want you to see the direct beam because that's really strong. I mean, it won't hurt your eyes, but it'll keep you from seeing the other things we want to see. Okay, now, so back at the back of the room there is this laser light that comes and hits the screen at this point. This is the view from the ceiling. And the light is 633 nanometer wavelength. Okay, and it's 10.6 meters. I measured it from the screen to that. Okay, now, then he's going to put, so go ahead and put in a slide, which is a picture of jail bars, right? Parallel lines. And you see what it did? It caused there to be a row of dots. Those are the angles, depending on the distance between successive lines, that the light gets the laser light gets deflected. Okay. Now here's a problem for you. There's what he's holding up, and the red dots are what happens. So the question is, this is a way of measuring the spacing between these lines. Right? We said there's this reciprocal relationship between the spacing between the lines and the distance here. Right? And this distance is 10.8 centimeters. I measured that once too. Okay? So what I want you to do to show that you've understood what happens here is you don't have to turn this in, but do it so you know you understand and you'll feel better as a person if you do this. Right? Use the fact that these are 10.8 centimeters apart and that this is 10.6 meters and that the light is 633 nanometer wavelength to figure out what that spacing is. Okay? Got the idea? And then he's going to show another one that has, instead of just individual lines, like those things in the thing I was doing with the projector, it's pairs of lines. So there's a pattern that's being repeated. Although the pattern is a very simple one. It's pairs of lines. And you can see that now it's again a certain spacing. But the intensity is modulated. Remember, we said that the intensity will change according to what the pattern is that's being repeated. Right? So, and now I'm going to... Then I'll show you what we're going to show, but we're not going to do it yet. Then I'm going to show what you'd get from a benzene molecule, C6, in a ring. All oriented the same way. That's not too realistic. All oriented the same way, but randomly distributed. If they're randomly distributed, you can show that what you're going to get is what you'd get for just one of them, but n times as strong if you have n of them there randomly distributed. Okay? Okay, so we're going to see what a single molecule would do. And then we're going to see what this, he's going to hold, put this slide in, which is the same thing except all the molecules are in pairs. Okay, it's a random collection of pairs of molecules, so it's a bigger pattern. And then he's going to do, which is a random distribution of quartets of molecules, and then he's going to do one which is a lattice of molecules, all of them regularly spaced. And finally, he's going to do the filament of a light bulb, an old-fashioned light bulb when they were just spirals. Right? Yeah, the light is always coming from the back, and he's holding the thing, and it's going to be projected on the screen. Now I'm going to close this and turn the projector off, but not the screen. Pardon me? Oh, yeah, I got to move this beam catcher down. Thank you. Can't turn the projector off without jostling the screen, it turns out. Okay, I'm going to turn the room lights out, and then Let's go through the whole set of slides. Okay, start at number one again, if you don't mind, Andrew. One, two, three. It should be that one. Yeah. Okay. Off. Desktop. Hey. Okay. So there's the jail bars. Okay. Now notice what would happen if he rotates the slide. Rotate it. It's always perpendicular to the direction the bars go. But if he rotates it around a vertical axis, that changes the distance between the bars. Keep it in the beam. So it changes the distance between the spots in a reciprocal way. Okay, next. And now the random hexagons. The third one, yeah. Let me move this over just a bit. There. Okay, so it's like a snowflake. And now, pairs of hexagons. So it's the same snowflake. That's the fundamental hexagon pattern. But I got to kill these lights too. But it's got bars across it because those two hexagons are interfering with one another. And now the quartets. Can you guess what's happened when we go from a pair to a set of four at the corners of a parallelogram? If the pair gave those bars, anybody guess? You're going to get bars going in both directions once we get the slide in there. There, okay? But it's the same fundamental scattering, right? The underlying intensity comes from that hexagon pattern. But then where you can observe it depends on the distance between hexagons. And now finally the lattice. So it's the same intensity distribution, but you can only see it at certain really fine positions. Remember we said if there's a very long row of things, you can only see it at very well-defined angles. And now all that intensity is concentrated in these few positions. So now I can see spots out here because I'm close to the screen that are 2 meters away from the center because all that intensity is focused into these little dots. And finally, the last one we're going to show is the scattering from a helix, from the light bulb filament. There. Now that's hard to see. If they were arbitrary light bulb filaments, I could get one that was just right. But can anybody describe this to me? What do you see for a pattern? It's an X, and the X is there are dots along the arms of the X. Got it? How many cannot see that? Don't be shy. It's dark. I won't even know who you are. Everybody can see that it's an X of dots? Okay, where have you seen that pattern before? In Rosalind Franklin's picture of the helix. But hers is not a helix like this is. It's a double helix. And next time we'll talk about that. Okay, so now I'll get you some light. Here. Okay? So, we'll see you next time. And do read this stuff because it helps a lot. Actually, give it to Eugene. Eugene, could you collect the problem sets as they go out? It'll be or tell them to leave it on the table or whatever's convenient for you.
Question. You said that when you see the angles on the screen, they tell you what the spacing is, and the intensity tells you what the pattern is. What's the difference between the spacing and the pattern?
If you just had dots, they'd be the single dots, they'd be the same thing. But in the case that we were showing with the benzene, it's hexagon is the pattern, but then it gets repeated. A pair of hexagons, four hexagons, or a whole lattice of hexagons.
With just intensity, you can tell what the...
But it's what gets repeated over a long distance. That's the lattice. But then at each point in the lattice, there's a given pattern, like that hexagon. And you saw that there was the intensity of the snowflake.
Uh-huh.
When you put when you make those things, those hexagons, into a lattice, you see the same intensity that would come from a single molecule. But you can only see it at certain angles because of the interference between this set of hexagons, this hexagon, this hexagon, this hexagon.
Is there a section on Sunday?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the undergraduates will have their normal review session on Sunday.
I have a question. This is cool. If I wanted to study, would it be within the realm of physics or chem?
Pardon me? If you wanted to do what?
To study this kind of stuff, would it be within the realm of physics?
It could be either. It's more, I'd say now it's more chemistry. When it was being discovered, it was physics. So the first people are physics, but the people who do the ribosome structure are chemists and even biologists now, or biophysicists.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah.
I just had a question. What is the scattering vector?
It's a mathematical concept, right? And it's perpendicular to the layer of things that are doing the scattering, or it's the thing that bisects the incoming and the outgoing rays. There's an angle, right? That's the direction of the scattering vector. But it's not only a direction, which is that bisector, it's also a distance. And the distance has to do with how far apart successive planes are. Right, so the further apart the planes are, the shorter the scattering vector is.
Because it's in between.
Because that's this reciprocal relationship we talked about. Right? So if you have a lattice, you'll have certain scattering vectors where things from successive planes will reinforce from successive units. But then the intensity that you get at those particular angles for a particular scattering vector, the intensity of the light that comes out at that particular angle depends on the pattern that's being repeated in a lattice. And that's what we demonstrated here at the end, that if you have a pattern of hexagons, if you have just one of them, you see a snowflake. No, you see a snowflake pattern, right? But if you have two of them and you see a snowflake with bars across it, and the bars come from the interference between the two snowflakes.
Okay.
And if you have four, you get more dark lines. And if you have a whole lattice, then you see only points. Each point corresponded to a particular scattering vector.
Okay.
And the intensity of that point came from the hexagon pattern.
Okay.
So it's like looking at that snowflake through a pegboard. You know what a pegboard is? I'll show a picture of it next time so you'll see.
Okay. And so the scattering vector represents... Like,
that just tells you what angle
are not scattered, like which are in phase, the certain lines.
Yeah, the scattering vector is the line that bisects the incoming and the outgoing beam. Okay, now you could have an outgoing beam in any direction, but because of these properties of the lattice and things reinforcing and canceling one another, if you have a whole bunch of them, you get intensity only at certain ones of those, only at very well-defined angles or certain scattering vectors. Because the scattering vector is the angle.
Yeah.
The bisects the angle.
So most of the light being given off cancels out.
Yeah, in almost all directions it cancels out for that reason we talked about.
Yeah.
Remember, the first one will cancel the 98th and the next one cancels the 99th.
And only like the perfect...
And only when it's perfectly on the maximum of every one do they necessarily reinforce if you have a pattern that goes over a long distance. So those are those different directions.
Mm-hmm.
But then the intensity that you get at that direction has to do with what the pattern was that's being repeated from one to the next, like the hexagon.
Okay, I think I'm getting that. And then,
This is all on the web, so I'm saying this is not second nature to most people.
I read this
on Wednesday.
like you doing the demo just like made it a lot more clear.
Yeah, I think seeing the real thing helps.
Yeah.
But it's good to, I'm sure you were helped by having read it ahead of time.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
Terminology-wise is when the peaks and the troughs match up, is that the same as constructive interference?
Yeah, yeah. Because remember, what does the peak and the trough mean? What does a peak mean?
Points most in the oscillation.
But what do you mean most in? It means that an electric charge is feeling a big force.
Right.
So if it feels a big force because of what comes from this electron, and it also feels a big force in the same direction, comes from this, then it feels a really big force.
So constructive.
But if those two forces are in opposite directions, then they cancel.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. You have to remember what light is. It's electric field.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? So if two things are giving electric fields and they add, then you get something big. If they're opposite, you get nothing.
Yeah, it's just like adding functions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I had one more question. So you said that, let's say you have like a haphazard collection of electrons, you can layer them such that they all fall on...
Not necessarily, but if you can layer them, then you'll get it strong. If you can layer most of them, but a few of them are not on that, then you'll still get pretty strong because those few will be tending to cancel or not reinforce very well. But the ones that are on the lines will all be reinforcing at particular angles or particular scattering
and
vectors.
And then you'll have the concentrated beam of light.
So what you look at is in a real molecule, there'll be some atoms that have lots of electrons. Those are the most important ones because electrons are what doing the scattering.
Yeah.
Right? So if you can find some direction where those ones that have a lot of electrons fall on evenly spaced lines, then you're going to get a lot of scattering in that direction.
And that gives you more information?
Well, that's what you're trying to find out, is where the electrons are, what the pattern is of electrons.
Okay, so... Wait, so then you have to know where they are before you shine the beam, or do you...
No. What you do is you use one of those machines and you find out where all these intensities are. And then you say, aha, there's a really bright spot. Mm-hmm. And it's at a certain angle of deflection, right? Yeah. Therefore, there must be lots of electrons that lie on that most of which lie on planes that are spaced at this distance in this direction in order to give that spot. But they're also a really bright spot over here, so they almost also must lie on this set of planes that are a certain distance apart. And you can see that if you have enough of those, it's probably possible somehow to put that information together to get what the pattern was.
Yeah.
That's how it works. But it's not something you can sit down and do with a pencil and paper in any real case. There are fancy computer programs that people got Nobel Prizes for developing to allow you to go back. If you start with the electrons, then it's easy to find out what the scattering should be. But if you start with the scattering and have to go backwards to figure out where the electrons were, that's a much harder problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But going the one way, going from the electrons to what the scattering should be, if you understand that, at least you understand why, how X-ray works, even if you can't yourself do the math that would allow you to go backwards. At least you can see that there's a relationship.
Well, it'd be, I guess, the inverse, right? Or I guess it's a little...
You use Fourier transforms to do it. And then there's this thing called the phase problem that we needn't go into here. But it was enough that it deserved a Nobel Prize when people figured it out.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Sodium chloride, which is what the Braggs did, is very simple because it's a cubic lattice and only two things there, sodium and chlorine. So that one they could do in their head. So young Lawrence Bragg did it in his head. Or, you know, with simple math. But if you're doing a ribosome, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Okay?
So I'm still confused. Like, how do you determine, like, where the electrons are once, with the patterns?
You can see that there's a relationship that where the dots come has to do with the lattice, the spacing XYZ.
And
a unit cell, right? There's the way crystals are put together is that there's a certain pattern of atoms, like the atoms in a ribosome. That's a certain pattern, which would give a certain like snowflake pattern that we showed from just a hexagon. Okay.
Yeah.
And then these molecules in the ribosome pack together in a crystal, in a lattice. Now the spacing in the lattice, this long range repeat, determines what angles light will come out at. But the actual structure within the ribosome, where the atoms are within a given individual ribosome, that determines how intense those lights, those spots are.
Okay.
Yeah. And there obviously is a relationship. But to solve the problem of starting with the dots and their intensities, the pattern of dots and their intensities, the X-ray scattering, and to go backwards, to get what the lattice is, the spacing, that's simple. But to get what the pattern is very complicated, and really fancy computer programs are used to do that.
All right.
But the purpose in this class is to see why it is that there's information in X-ray scattering that can tell you where electrons are in molecules.
All right. So, all right, I understand.
Good.
All right, thank you.
Okay.